Good room to go.
Legal submissions, which I'll take you through first, and then call Ms. Sullivan, followed by Ms. Dowd, to provide just brief summaries and then respond to any questions that you may have. We also have Nick Wyatt here with us, one of Aurora's design engineers, if you have sort of questions of a technical nature in relation to the sort of network engineering side of things. I perhaps might take you through the introduction in my submissions. It covers much of the same ground as what is in evidence from Mr. Sullivan and Ms. Dowd, just about the background to Aurora and the nature of its network. Turning then to paragraph 8 of my submission, I just covered very briefly there the assessment process that you have to undertake in assessing the plan. I haven't provided a huge amount of detail there, as I imagine over the course of these hearings you have heard from numerous legal counsel what that process is, and from the review of the legal submission that I've seen, I don't have anything new to add to that. So I've just highlighted the main points there and we'll move on. The first thing I'd like to go through in more detail is in relation to the proposed objectives and policies in the proposed plan. It is submitted that the notified objectives and policies within Chapter 30 provide an adequate recognition and support to protect Aurora's infrastructure and enable the development of it. This applies to the whole network, but is particularly important for Aurora's critical infrastructure. Whilst the policy specifically recognised the national grid consistent with the national policy statement on electricity transmission, there must also be recognition for the distribution network in order to implement the regional policy statement and the proposed regional policy statement and in my submission to achieve the purpose of the Act.
Is that really correct? The provisions for proposed regional policy statement policies, they don't require zone provisions be included, do they? They don't have methods that say territorial authorities must include these things.
No, they don't. But I think the policy direction within the policy statement is reasonably emphatic in the sense that it does require protection of the infrastructure. So, I mean, it's not unusual, I suppose, for a policy statement to be absent of specific methods, and that's, I think, where the territorial authorities and the district councils can choose the methods which they consider appropriate. And our submission is that the appropriate method in this case is the identification of the critical lines, not all of the distribution network, and to confer a level of protection over that critical infrastructure. I have, and I'm covering, I suppose, that point in a little bit more detail as I work through the submission. Obviously, the ORC are yet to release their decisions on submissions in relation to the proposed regional policy statement, and as a result, it is a matter to which you must have regard under Section 74(2)(a) Roman 1 of the Act. Of particular interest are the following objectives and policies, which I've set out there, the provisions which I consider to be most relevant, and I won't take you through those in any great detail. As I've mentioned, I believe there is a clear direction within the proposed regional policy statement that protection should not be limited to nationally significant infrastructure only, but applies to regionally significant infrastructure. infrastructure and infrastructure more generally. Objectives 3.4 and 3.6 seek to enable the more efficient transport of electricity as well as protect electricity distribution infrastructure. It is submitted that the best way to enable and protect Aurora's network in Queenstown Lakes is to amend the objectives and policies as requested by Aurora, and the proposed amendments strike a more appropriate balance between protection of the infrastructure and managing its effects. In my submission, considerable weight should be given to the provisions of the proposed regional policy statement in assessing the appropriateness of the proposed plan. This approach is consistent with the court's findings in Winston Aggregates and Papakura District Council, where the court found that while the Act does not require that a proposed plan be consistent with a proposed regional policy statement, in giving weight to it, the court was mindful of the desirability of striking a balance between obligations and functions now and in the future.
Yes, the provisions of the proposed regional policy statement following the issue of decisions that we must have weight to give, isn't it?
Well, no. I mean, it's a proposed policy statement now.
But the council won't be making a decision on our recommendations for next year sometime.
Which council, sorry?
This district council.
Yes.
So this decision will be made on the basis of our recommendations next year sometime,
mm-hmm.
which will be after the regional council's decisions have been released.
Well, we hope so.
Well, they promised them in the beginning of October now.
So
they did actually have 2016 after it. So I'm working on the presumption that sometime within the next 12 months we will see those, and those are the ones, those provisions are the ones that we need to give weight to, is that?
Well, yes, I think so. I mean, obviously, once the regional council's decision is released, that does give you, I think, a clearer indication of the direction that they choose to take. And to a certain degree, we're speculating about the decision that they will make. Aurora is...
Everyone's optimistic.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we have to, you know, bear in mind what the provisions included when they were notified, and the fact that the council will have undertaken an assessment about the notified provisions and their ability to achieve the purposes of the Act. So there would have to be good reasons why those provisions would change. So as they stand now, I think there's a clear direction about the protection of infrastructure, whether it be regionally significant or otherwise, and in an submission, that's something that you should give weight in making your decision. Obviously, if the provisions change significantly through the decision process, then you will have to have regard to that. And obviously, in these submissions, I can't see, you can guess what that might look like.
Neither can we.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
it does, and I suppose the principle is that it is a matter to which you have to have regard, and I'm saying that relative to the operative regional policy statement, which is now reasonably old, what we're seeing from the proposed regional policy statement is more detail and direction about the manner in which infrastructure should be managed.
Does the operative regional policy statement actually tell us anything?
There's not a lot in there that's particularly helpful. There is, I think, one objective in a couple of the policies that talk about infrastructure and managing the effects of it, but it certainly doesn't provide the level of detail that the proposed regional policy statement has. The themes are kind of the same, just not as well articulated.
So, essentially your submission is that whichever version we have before us of the proposed regional policy statement is deserving of more weight than the operative version.
I think so, at this point in the process. I think the proposed regional policy statement has been assessed by the council in accordance with the Act. It reflects how they believe that their functions need to be exercised under the Act in these more recent times. And there is a point, I think, which that balance between the operative and the proposed policy statements begins to tip. And I think we're very near to, if not at that point. Following on from that, I think the approach of giving the regional policy statement more weight achieves the efficient administration of the council's functions under the Act. If adequate regard is not had to the proposed regional policy statement, you risk the proposed plan being inconsistent with it and necessitating further plan changes down the track in order to give effect to the operative policy statement once it becomes operative. It is submitted that if you ignore the clear direction in the proposed regional policy statement, it would be foolhardy. Equally, the failure to recognise and adequately provide for Aurora's distribution network cuts across some of the strategic directions within the proposed plan itself. For example, Goal 3.2.2, which seeks to achieve the strategic and integrative management of urban growth. This cannot be achieved without adequate consideration of the provision of electricity. There is a telling lack of consideration given to the importance of network utilities within the notified plan. This was perhaps best demonstrated by the absence of any specific objective or policy recognition for network utilities within the strategic direction section. That shortcoming has of course been dealt with during earlier hearings and will hopefully be rectified. Unfortunately, the same shortcoming has continued through the utilities chapter. For example, objective 30.2.6 seeks to ensure that the well-being of the community is supported by the establishment, continued operation and maintenance of utilities. However, the subsequent policies and rules do not actually facilitate this outcome.
Are you suggesting here that if the district plan wasn't facilitative and enabling, Aurora wouldn't provide electricity to the district?
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying it becomes less efficient to do that.
I'm still not convinced. Isn't the purpose of a utility, or put this way, the focus of the district plan is to enable urban development. Utilities support that. It's in Aurora's best interests, given its business model, for there to be urban growth. The more electricity it sells, the more income Aurora has, or the more electricity it carries, to be more precise, the more income that Aurora has, and the more people connected to the lines. So it seems to me that Aurora has its own incentive to provide infrastructure. All the district plan really has to do is to make sure it's not inhibiting in a way that would inhibit the development of the urban areas.
I think there's two parts to that issue, I think. There's Aurora's existing network and the need to be able to carry out the necessary maintenance and upgrading and so on of that existing network. Some of that is just, I suppose, natural replacement requirements as things get old. Other parts of that are where, as you say, urban growth or increasing demand requires that infrastructure to be upgraded and enlarged to provide that supply. The more regulatory or the greater degree of regulatory intervention in that, the more costly and time consuming that process becomes, which inevitably has flow on effects for the ability for Aurora to provide that infrastructure and to enable that development that you speak of. So I think in some ways, yes, you're right, that urban growth catalyses the need for development and Aurora has an interest in that continuing, but equally over-regulating that utility activity puts a handbrake on that urban growth cycle. And so what we're saying is that we need to strike a balance between the two. We need to recognise that yes, utilities can have effects, but equally there is an advantage to the community in those utilities being provided for and being able to be established efficiently. And that's really the balance that Aurora is trying to strike with the amendments that it's seeking. So the day-to-day maintenance and upgrading of Aurora's local distribution network is also important, and the notified proposed district plan does not adequately recognise the location, technical and operational factors that influence the placement and design of Aurora's infrastructure. These requirements can make alternative routes or other mitigation methods impossible or highly undesirable. The amendment of policy 32.6.2 is a welcome change in this regard. Turning now to the critical electricity lines. As set out in the evidence of Mr. Sullivan, Aurora has a responsibility to manage the risks to its infrastructure and avoid or minimise those risks to ensure the safe and secure electricity to the city. Aurora has heightened responsibilities where electricity...
I know that it's, you know, extending the lines helps the Leeds and City ratepayers, but I'm...
Some of them might disagree with you about that. I should have changed that to the district, but yes, we'll move on. Aurora has heightened responsibilities where electricity is being supplied to important community services and infrastructure, such as hospitals and airports. To help satisfy its obligations in this regard, Aurora seeks protection of approximately 276 kilometres of its Queenstown network by identifying its critical electricity lines on the district plan map.
Are you able, or is someone from Aurora able to tell us how many landowners that affects?
I think, Joanne, had you done?
I can save it for the staff.
It's not something that I could quantify, but there would be quite a considerable number of landowners over that volume of land. I think in this subdivision evidence that we tabled and the response to questions showed that most of the lines, 50% of them, would be in private ownership. So, yeah, quite a significant proportion of them would be in owned by private individuals.
Did Aurora notify those landowners that it was going to be seeking these provisions and it's before it lodged the submissions?
Not before submissions, no. It obviously would have been notified as part of the district plan review.
So those landowners would have had 10 working days to, and how would they have known that the submission was going to affect them? I raised this because there's an issue of procedural fairness, isn't there? We've got a large number of landowners who may have restrictions imposed on their land that have not been advised of these particular rules. It's not as if it was notified with them that they can be had the transfer. Given the Parliament has seen worthy of only requiring 10 working days, and I think in fact this council had a slightly longer further submission period. The summary comprised two Eastlake funders. I'm wondering whether it is fair to expect the council to impose rules on people who don't know that they're likely to be imposed on them.
Yeah, I suppose, I think rather than it being a question of procedural fairness, I think it's probably more a question of scope and whether or not that submission was on the plan change, I think is the...
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that that's on the plan.
Yeah, and I think...
There is no doubt about that, but it's of a different nature of someone who's sort of rezoning someone's land. You would know to look, you know, if your land was identified in the submission, but the only way you'd know is by reading the appendix to Laura's submission, that it might affect your land.
Mm. I think, I mean, landowners will know if they had electricity lines on their land. And I suppose to that extent, the rules and provisions that we're seeking with respect to those critical lines aren't imposing regulatory constraints beyond what already exists.
Well, no, they are. That's where I disagree. Yeah. At the moment, the code requires Aurora's approval to do certain activities, and to do that requires the landowner to contact Aurora and get that approval. The rules, as I read them, that Aurora proposing require a consent being requested from the district council.
Mm-hmm.
Which requires the payment of a fee, which is not inconsiderable. And then once they have that consent, they still have to go to Aurora and get approval under the code, because the council can't provide that approval. So there's an imposition which has been imposed on those people.
If I can maybe just interject, and I know I've stopped my turn, I think the submission that we had originally lodged with council was that the activity would have been permitted, and it really was a requirement for landowners to consult with Aurora if they were seeking to build. So it was effectively reinforcing the provisions under the code, but obviously having a spatial thing to look at, so you know, there's a requirement people will look at the RMA documents and say, okay, well, what's that, what's this line that I need to comply with? It's just a bit more obvious. The only requirement under the proposal that we had in the submission related to if buildings were actually going to encroach within the NZECP 34 setback requirements, then a consent requirement would have eventually from then.
But they wouldn't otherwise require consent.
No, but that's, yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah.
And I suppose that's the resource management question for you, is given the importance of these critical electricity lines and the benefits that they provide to the community and the importance of avoiding reverse activity or adverse effects on those lines, is that regulatory imposition appropriate? In Aurora's view it is. It's a relatively limited link of the network, and for parts of the network that are important, you know, they supply a significant number of customers, including lifeline utilities, or communities where alternative supply is not available in the event of an outage. So in order to protect that, we're saying let's put in a set of rules which is to a large extent consistent with the existing regulatory framework, but in an environment which people are generally more familiar with and tend to engage with more frequently. And so it provides an opportunity to help minimise and manage the potential adverse effects that other activities that take place on land can have on the infrastructure, which is also a physical resource that needs to be managed.
Isn't it just a duplication of what's already required by the code, given what you just said of its purpose?
Yes, it is. Yeah. However, what Aurora's experience is that people are, to a large extent, unaware that the code exists. And there have been a number of instances, as you will have seen from Mr. Sullivan's evidence, where landowners carry on activities or buildings get constructed under lines, and then that presents a risk to the network. Or what happens, and has happened, is that council grants resource consent for an activity that encroaches within the lines. Aurora finds out about that, and landowners get extremely irritated that they are then required to go back to the council and vary their resource consent in order to enable them to undertake the activity that they wanted. So essentially, you know, it is a duplication in the sense that it isn't seeking to constrain activities more or less than exist, but it's trying to use a regulatory framework that people will engage with more readily than the NZECP 34.
In this, considering the proposals put forward by Aurora, when we look at the alternatives, should we consider the alternative of notice of requirement? Because as I understand it, if the lines were designated, then the requirement on the landowners then is to get Aurora's approval of section 176, which is a no-cost requirement to the landowner, and gets direct communication to Aurora without the council's involvement. And we have to consider the efficiency and effectiveness of provisions.
Yes. I think you also need to consider the efficiency and effectiveness of the designation process.
Well, it would identify it on the plan in the same way, putting lines on plan maps in the same way.
The designation process we have tended to steer away from because, and as you will have heard from Federation Farmers, or heard, but perhaps read from Federation Farmers, landowners are inherently suspicious of constraints over their land. Designations, of course, trigger the Public Works Act provisions, and a landowner subject to a designation may essentially require that land to be compulsorily acquired. Our experiences, and I think, you know, this wouldn't be unique to Aurora, is that people don't like designations which come with that sort of compulsory acquisition process sitting over their land. Certainly, if you look at examples of transport designations and so on, they do tend to have an impact on the use that the land subject to those designations can be put to.
It's a matter of the rules that apply. If you take the airport company's designation in respect of the approach paths, those, the only effect they have is stop penetration of those planes.
Mm-hmm.
I stand to be corrected, but I am unaware of any landowner in New Zealand asking an airport company to purchase their land because there's an approach path over it. And if Aurora's rules that attach the designation merely said that you need our approval under the electricity code to do these works, I'm not sure that there's much in the Public Works Act that is going to require Aurora to acquire that land, is there? Because it's only stating.
The Public Works Act doesn't require it, but a landowner could.
They can see it, but yeah. I mean, they'd be pushing their luck in the High Court, I would have thought.
When
it actually doesn't impose an imposition on them, that isn't other than
that inherently affected. I think the airport approach paths, I think, is a slightly different creature. because it doesn't tend to affect land perhaps to the same extent, and I think people have been living with those things for a considerable period of time. In our experience, that designation process is something that landowners are very wary of, and so what we have tried to do through this process is achieve that level of kind of awareness about these critical lines without sort of spooking, I suppose, the landowners that are affected by that.
Well, in fact, I think quite frank, by the way you've done it, you won't be spooking them. They won't know about it.
Well, except for the fact that the lines are existing and they have them on their land. So, I suppose, takes me back to the point. We're not asking for controls that are more onerous than exists. What we are asking for is a framework that enables those people to be more aware of what their obligations are.
The law is not asking for anything more onerous than what exists, and surely nothing more than advice and action plan is needed.
Perhaps. I don't know, I mean, where do you put an advice note so that it achieves, I mean, perhaps if you identify the lines so that people can see them on the map, and that's accompanied with an advice note, that certainly goes some way to solving the problem. But our preference would be the rules that accompany that identification. So I'll start at paragraph 25. The changes to the objectives and policies to protect sub-transmission lines as recommended in the section 42A report are supported. Unfortunately, this does not provide adequate protection for all of Aurora's critical electricity network. In particular, the Wanaka to Makarora line, which is not a sub-transmission line at present. However, given the isolated community that it serves, with little opportunity for alternative supply, it is considered by Aurora to be a critical line. Aurora accepts that the balance of its distribution network is not critical, and for that reason has not sought a higher degree of protection for it. The author of the Section 42A report appears to have misunderstood the nature of the Wanaka to Makarora line. The planner notes that the lines that extend from Wanaka to Makarora are considered regionally significant. However, the proposed amendments do not provide for this line to be protected because the line is an 11 kV line. It is submitted that the 11 kV line from Wanaka to Makarora should be included within the definition of sub-transmission lines, and Ms. Dart has provided a suggested amendment to address this. I won't go through paragraph 27 because I think we've traversed that through the questions that I've been responding to. And perhaps just emphasising that the reason that we're speaking this is about that lack of awareness in relation to the code and trying to put in place a framework which addresses those reverse sensitivity issues which Mr. Sullivan's evidence traversed in more detail.
Who's responsible for enforcing the code?
WorkSafe. And the Aurora's enforcement tools are in essence zero. So far as I am aware, WorkSafe have not initiated any type of enforcement action under the code. Aurora have mechanisms available to them in the civil jurisdiction for breach of statutory duty, but if you can
have...
they can't do that either. none of those options are really viable. They could perhaps initiate a private prosecution under the Electricity Act, but again, all that would do is penalise the person for the offence committed. It wouldn't actually require anything to be done to fix it.
Have you ever done that?
No. You can imagine how people would react to Aurora prosecuting people. It's really not a viable option, and neither is a civil proceeding for breach of statutory duty. It's just not really worth it.
But by putting the rules in your plan, Aurora would be expecting the council to prosecute people.
Mm-hmm. Well, although Aurora could exercise powers in terms of seeking enforcement orders under the Regional Management Act, that's an enforcement power that is not limited to the council alone.
I understand.
So it does make enforcement more straightforward. However, that isn't really the end game that Aurora are trying to achieve. It's not about having a mechanism that they can easily go beating people with sticks over. It's about increasing awareness of the obligations under the code. And Aurora's expectation is that through that consent process, it will really be about ensuring that either works are outside of that buffer zone, or if they are going to be within it, that there are appropriate engineering solutions applied to the line network that deals with any reversal activity effects that might arise. So it's a parachute at the top of the hill rather than an ambulance at the bottom. Turning to paragraph 32, the section 42A report has assessed the proposed provisions and confirms that the standards for restricting buildings within the 10 metres of the sub-transmission line is consistent with the NZEC P34, and these amendments are evidence in the recommended changes to Rule 30.5.10.
What is the code actually? So it's 10 metres in the code, is it?
It very much depends on the voltage of the line. The code was attached to my evidence,
yep.
So I think at 66 kV it's 9.5 metres, and at 33 it's
8.5.
Between 11 and 33
kV,
8.5.
The span of 125 metres.
Yeah.
So that goes up as the span between poles increases.
So what's in the proposed to go into 48 is stricter than the code? And how does that relate to the NES on transmission? What's the number in that one?
I think I don't know if there's limits set in the what Transpro tends to do is they set different sort of limits, but I believe there's maybe 12 metres for sensitive buildings or sensitive activities within the National Grid Yard, I think is the word.
Aurora has some further amendments to manage the effects of trees within proximity to the line and with respect to the activity status for consent required. Aurora has thought that it be restrictive discretionary, and the section 42A report has recommended non-complying. We don't think that non-complying is necessary because it is about potentially
probably out of scope too.
yes, that you're possibly right. You know, it is about just vetting what is proposed and ensuring that methods are adopted if something is to occur within that setback to manage the risk that that poses. So non-compliant activity has seen somewhat of a sledgehammer to apply. Turning to the other issues of concern to Aurora, and this typically relates to the expansion of the distribution network or maintenance of it more generally rather than in relation to the critical electricity infrastructure. The first is in relation to visual amenity. Aurora made submissions with respect to Rule 30.4.11 and the matters of control, specifically relating to visual amenity effects of new lines and associated port structures. The planner has rejected Aurora's submission on the basis that, especially in its outstanding natural landscape, there is an onus to ensure that the visual effects of any structures are mitigated. Aurora submits that there are several practical hurdles to overcome that limit the potential for visual mitigation to occur. Ms. Dowd's evidence outlines the constraints that Aurora has in regards to design and materials available to meet the specification and structural integrity requirements for its electricity infrastructure. In many instances, it is impractical to mitigate the visual effects of new assets. Requirements to paint the port structures will result in significant construction and maintenance costs and have little effect on reducing the impact on visual amenity values. The Section 42A report refers to a telecommunications structure that was painted in a recessive colour to minimise visibility. It is submitted that whilst those mitigation methods may be feasible for telecommunications, they are not for electricity distribution due to the nature of the equipment and the fact that there are considerably more support structures required. This significantly exacerbates access issues and increases costs. Therefore, Aurora seek removal of appearance, scale and visual effects from the matters for discretion for Rule 30.4.11.
Just on that point, I raised before the matter of Aurora's business and that the increased flow of electricity across its line network is beneficial for its business. In this district, more so than any of the other districts that Aurora serves, the tourism industry is actually what generates the demand in all ways, both in terms of urban development and use of electricity. So isn't it in Aurora's best interests to do its utmost to ensure that tourist demand, which is based on the outstanding natural landscapes, continues?
Steve, can I that question to you, because it's really a
business question, but I think it's wise to ask at this point.
Do you want to answer that now? I'll come back to it.
We were just saying, much of Aurora's demand for electricity here in the central Otago area is actually generated via irrigation and not tourism. A lot comes back to the nature of the load as opposed to the specific requirements.
Well, you said central Otago, but I'm talking about Queenstown Lake.
So am I, when I
know there's no irrigation irrigators there are in this district. And so you're suggesting that the electricity demand in the upper Clutha is more significant than that in the Waikato Basin.
It is heading that way.
Yes.
There is obviously still, you know, the major load centre of Queenstown that's growing with all the hotel use, and they're not very energy efficient users, seeing as there's the nature of the tourist. But
isn't it true though that the amount of land that can be irrigated in this district is probably just about there? 12 of 96.4% of the district as an outstanding natural landscape. And that is the figure that we've had the council calculate for us. That leaves 3.6% of the area available for urban development and irrigation farming. And
so, I mean, that assumes that no irrigation takes place within outstanding natural landscapes, and I'm not sure that's true.
The outstanding natural landscapes are generally not suitable for irrigation, is probably the nicest term you could use. There is some in the Cadrona Valley, which is an ONL, and there is some other irrigation down there.
I suppose it's relatively little electricity demand from the outstanding natural landscape, apart from the ski fields.
But that alters the point that there will be continued tourism growth, that the irrigation is a rapid and sudden arrival. But I would not expect that to continue to grow at the same rate, given that there's an absolute land constraint.
I think it's not so much whether the growth that occurs, but actually the amount of load that is actually consumed by the individual ICPs, if you want to look at it like that. You know, a large irrigator, whether that land mass is actually growing or not, will consume a large amount of electricity pumping water around, whereas a single household clearly doesn't, and it's a many-to-one relationship in terms of the electricity that they use on a yearly basis. So, for example, you could actually have, you know, excessive growth in terms of your minor ICP generated through tourism, and they're still not going to come anywhere near the demand of those large irrigators.
So what's an ICP?
Customer point of supply.
Basically. Right. Mm-hmm. Individual customer point or something. Right.
The effect of Rule 13.4.11 is of particular concern given the lack of clarity about the establishment of utilities within roads. If this rule applies to roads, then all new lines will require resource consent, which comes at a significant cost both in terms of time and money. It does not enable the well-being of the community to be supported by the efficient establishment of infrastructure. I note that in the council's opening, Mr. Barr foreshadowed an additional permitted activity rule for utilities within road reserve. Aurora is very supportive of such an addition, subject to review of the proposed text.
So could you explain for us, why is it not clear in the rules that it covers roads?
And I had tried to have a discussion with Mr. Barr about this prior to the hearing, but we've been playing phone tag. Under the operative plan, the roads are not zoned, and so the provisions don't apply to the roads. And so activities have can take place within the roads on a permitted basis. It's not clear to me from the proposed plan whether roads are zoned, and whether or not the district-wide provisions, which the network utilities provisions are, apply. Well, my understanding is they apply to zones. It doesn't say that the specific works in all zones isn't in the rule around lines and support structures, but my understanding is that the provisions of the utility section apply to all zones. And I don't know, and can't figure out from the plan itself, whether roads have a zoning. So that was the point of my inquiry to Mr. Barr previously, is what is that provision? And That's
the
main my question to an extent.
And was the rule that they that has been included in here say that this rose?
It hasn't been included, and I listened to some of the introductory discussion on the first day of the hearing, and I think Mr. Barr, you had perhaps suggested that there should be a permitted activity rule included for the establishment of network utilities within roads.
I understood that was listed because the provisions of the proposed plan apply in all areas rather than the zones.
That was the distinction.
It's a bit of a lack of clarity. And in terms of where the roads are zoned, I can advise that I've raised that with council for the council, and they are currently dealing with that in the designation stream.
Yeah. I suppose that with the designation, for activities that aren't the designated activity. That problem continues to exist.
Well, the offer plan just has to comply with section 9.
So it struck me as a lacuna that was in the old Act, and it was not abundantly clear whether or not that lacuna remained or had been specifically dealt with. But the effect of it is if we are into a consent process for all of our new lines and support structures, then that is of particular concern to Aurora. Turning to temporary electricity generation and noise, Aurora submitted on Rule 30.4.6 relating to non-renewable electricity generation. Emergency backup generators are vital in maintaining supply of electricity during times of supply interruption. And there are in essence two parts to that. There's the emergency supply when there is an outage caused by storms and vehicle crashes and so on, and there's also temporary outages as a result of maintenance and upgrade works. In both instances, the use of temporary backup generators is short term, but critical to Aurora being able to maintain supply. Given that, it is considered inappropriate to require compliance with the noise standards in Chapter 36 for those temporary generators. That relief has been accepted in the Section 42A report. However, the Section 42A report rejects the relief that Aurora sought to include emergency generation within the definition of utility. This requires Aurora to rely on rule enabling non-renewable electricity generation, which is Rule 30.4.6, to operate what I'm calling non-emergency temporary generators, while the temporary activity rule 35.4.13 does not apply because that relates specifically to emergency generation. Rule 30.4.6 is not adequate because there would be very few instances where Aurora could comply with the requirement for the generation to only supply the site on which the generator is located. Generally, when these generators are relied on, it is to provide continuing supply to part of Aurora's network. Therefore, Aurora will be required to obtain consent each time it needs to use a backup generator to provide temporary supply during maintenance and upgrade works. This is inefficient and does not achieve the objectives of the proposed plan. It is submitted that there are two ways to address this issue. Either accept the relief sought in Aurora's original submission that the definition of utility be amended, or alternatively, Rule 30.4.6 can be amended to provide for temporary generators required for utility activities.
While we're on this, could you explain to us how, probably technically, how do you go about doing this temporary generator that you're using while you're doing this programmed maintenance, I'm assuming? How does it work?
Can I maybe just respond, because we have literally just done one on the Glenorchy line, and we had a 10 and all compliant resource concern, so we have located it where we have an existing substation, and we have located a, it's kind of like a container, so
right.
It's all baffled, so all the noise is contained within it. So it's on the opposite side of the road where all of the works are required, which occur up on the sort of the mountain that runs all the way through to the Norkey. So generally that's how we would do it. So
right.
We have.
So what's a 60-foot container or something?
20-foot
container.
40-foot
container.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically a
diesel
power generator.
Diesel generator.
And you put this on the road, and you, that's so that people, when you cut them off, effectively they don't get cut off because this generator continues to provide them with power.
Yeah, we step the power back up and feed the area like we would normally.
Mm-hmm. So you can cut out the entire Wormhole
yes.
Creek line.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then there's a long period of that doesn't feed anyone, does it? What we need to find is sharp turn as well.
Yeah.
It would be most instances, and I refer more to the replacement work in Dunedin, for example, which is happening up here as well. We'll have a generator in for 1 or 2 days while we do a changeover on a distribution substation in the street where there's no other way to feed the supply. So that's on a smaller scale than what Joanne was talking about at Glenorchy. And that will be a much smaller unit and will be located in particular, usually road reserve. And that will just be feeding the local low voltage network that feeds all the houses. So it'll be going down the street, tearing into all the houses.
In terms of the Glenorchy, short term?
The consent that we obtained was for 4 months, and then there were issues because of access and winter access conditions, and we then had to go back and amend that consent to extend the time period for until after winter so that we could do the works next year. That's kind of the issue that we have is for circumstances like that, it's a non-compliant resource consent that we have to obtain.
So more often than not, though, it would be on a smaller scale that Nick's talking about. The works that are going on at Glenorchy is a major upgrade of that particular section of line. So it is slightly different to normal circumstances.
That's what I was going to ask, because the Glenorchy one presumably is very infrequent, maybe once in the life of the plant.
I think the only other example of that I'm aware of is when the generator was put in at Cadrona to provide supply while the upgraded line was installed up the valley.
Which I think it's remained there now. It's been no, that's the one that's been generated.
So, yeah, those are relatively infrequent, the
bigger units. And then presumably also take place in more remote areas because you're dealing with bigger lines rather than smaller stations which may be in more urban areas.
Yes, the rural areas where it's usually a single source of supply because of economics, you'll find generators will likely be used for those big upgrades. And the work you'll find more in an urban area is less to do with the high voltage network and more to do with the low voltage. Mm-hmm. Because being in an urban area, you can backfeed areas through rings where you don't have that luxury in the rural area.
So if you want to do this back and forth, you're going to put something back and forth. I take it that Aurora then don't have generators for voltage drop, like they do. I know they do in some parts of Canterbury, very long lines. That's not an issue in this district.
We have considered it when we had the constraints with the irrigation, but we've been able to implement other solutions there around transformers that regulate the voltage halfway down the line.
Okay. I mean, the reason I'm asking this is because the way the rule was written to me is unclear. That it distinguishes between emergency situations and maintenance backup situations, and I raised these matters on Monday.
I think that's in relation to the temporary activity which provides for some temporary generation, that looked at it, I think, and reflected on the words of that, given the section 42A declining our relief on the definition, I think you take from that that is your true emergency sort of situation. So then it left us in a position, well, what are we doing for this maintenance and upgrade, which I think, you know, isn't an emergency because we plan for it.
If you've got a maintenance upgrade and we would provide for that in the rule, what would be a realistic time frame for it to be not requiring consent? There'd be a point at which it's too much, but what would Aurora consider?
Based on the experience of the knocking, I would say probably 5 months.
That seems rather excessive, given what Mr. Sullivan was.
I think the hard bit in answering that question is that it depends on the specific circumstances of the maintenance work that's being carried out. In some instances, like the work that Joanne's referring to at Glenorchy, 5 months probably is reasonable. In other circumstances, you might consider a month to be a reasonable time frame. And it really does come down to those specific circumstances.
There is also the timing of that work. Obviously, obtaining consent. Obviously, we have to get that before we can commit resource to being there on the day.
Well,
so there's a sort of timing all that together as well.
Yes.
So we wouldn't like to run a generator for 5 months, personally, as well.
I mean, economically.
The principle was a permitted activity rule. Seems to me what you're saying is with Glenorchy, that's unlikely to happen again for a few years. And what you're talking about is that you need it regularly in urban areas and the low voltage networks. Now, that's the one that I'm thinking should automatically be potentially permitted, but there should be some sort of time limit on that so that you don't have generators sitting in the urban area.
I tend to agree with you. From a network perspective, it's not something that we'd encourage either. Any form of backup generation is just that, it's a backup. It's not how we would choose to supply on a long-term basis, because it's simply not economically viable.
Except Genesis forces the price of power up.
which does also beg the question that if it became economically viable, is that something that you would consider?
No.
As a long-term solution?
As a potential?
Yeah, for a long term.
It would be very rare given the cost of electricity.
Isn't
diesel's not going down in price?
Isn't the rule constrained at how much generation it can put into the grid? Or can you put us unlimited into your own network?
I believe we are.
I don't remember just off the top of my head, but I think there are certain constraints around that because they're the lines company, not the generator.
Yes, that's
right. So you're not going to need that with squillions and quite a significant change to the business model.
Yes.
Which I suspect the Commerce Commission might have something to say about.
Well, I think it would be worthwhile between.
Yeah, we might reflect on that.
Reflect on that. I suspect you will go over lunch, and it might be something you might like to think and discuss amongst yourselves as to what is a reasonable time frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. The next matter is in relation to the definition of minor upgrading. So the notified definition was more restrictive than what is considered in the operative plan. And the reason for taking a more restrictive approach was not entirely clear from the Section 32 report. A definition which more accurately recognises the nature and scope of maintenance and minor upgrading activities is more appropriate and will better implement the objectives and policies. And Ms. Dower has provided a proposed definition in Appendix B to her evidence. The only significant deviation in the Section 32A report from the relief sought by Aurora relates to the ability to increase the height of support structures by up to 15%. The Section 42A report does not provide any explanation as to why this release has been rejected. Aurora has requested this release because it is not unusual for minor height increases to be encompassed in the replacement of a support structure. This is typically required to increase the resilience of the line. Increased heights can allow longer spans between support structures, which reduces safety risks along the roads and generally makes lines less vulnerable to damage from activities occurring at ground level. It also allows Aurora to meet newer safe electrical distance standards when lines are upgraded and adopt new and more efficient technologies. All of these things enable Aurora to provide a safe, reliable and resilient network, which will achieve objectives 30.2.5 and 30.2.6 of the proposed plan. Just to elaborate on that slightly, 15%, if it can, we come up with that, there have been some cases through the Environment Court assessing injurious affection, and essentially the Environment Court has landed on height increases of up to 15% as not having or causing injurious affection on landowners. Now that's not a resource management issue, but is related to the scope of upgrading works that Aurora can undertake under the Electricity Act as part of the existing use that the Electricity Act confers for existing lines installed prior to 1992. So it was a bit of method to the madness in coming up with the 15%, and that it is consistent with that other regulatory framework where Aurora can undertake that level of upgrade without needing to obtain new easements or deal with potential compensation issues for those existing lines.
In terms of the minor upgrade, I understood that Aurora was concerned about support structure replacement in the same location as the support structure is to be replaced. Is that in the South?
Yeah, I
have. Have you amended that part of minor upgrade in your evidence?
Yeah.
Okay. So for this, in addition to what's in the stout evidence, that's another matter that you just referred to our attention.
It has been addressed in mine as well. So I think for me that it was the consent requirement related to the inability to move a support structure without actually having to put it in exactly the same location. The point that Ms. Irvine has raised as well as sort of height, but I addressed that in my summary.
And I think if my memory serves me correctly, the original wording was that it had to go back in the same place, and I think the amended version provides for it to be adjacent to the existing support structure. So there was perhaps more wriggle room there than the notified version.
So it just seems to me, technically, you couldn't put it in the same place as the existing one is, because what would you do with it in the meantime when you were trying to take it out? Whereas it used to have a height located within 1 metre of the base of the support structure being replaced. So that's been taken out.
Yes.
Before you go away and put it in the same place. So technically, is 1 metre any better? How?
It depends on the soil.
Yeah.
What's something that might work?
What we have thought, we're going through the same process in Dunedin, is that in 2 to 5 metres. And again, the case law that Bridget is mentioning also provides for movement of existing support structures up to 5 metres without being injuriously affected, as long as it's not moved closer to residential property.
That actually works reasonably well for us in a variety of different environments. It enables us to make sure that we achieve the right alignment of the lines. It enables efficient work practices.
So it's effectively within 5 metres of wherever that, that's what you want.
And I believe there was also a number of support structures that was changed from single to multiple.
I think at the minute there's the operating plan provides for 3, and we've just had instances where it literally we might need a consent to put 4, and it was just again looking for some flexibility. The issue that we have is under the operative plan, those provisions don't apply in rural areas, where generally is where we actually need an extension of existing overhead, because generally in urban areas, associated new subdivisions are typically all placed underground.
I think when you shift in the poles though within 5 metres, if it's permitted under a road, then it's permitted anyway if it's within the road reserve. This would only apply when it's on private land, and you still have to get permission from those people to be doing stuff on their land anyway.
If it's pre-1992, no, and that's when the existing use rights comes into play. So if it's post-1992, we need to have easements put in place. So it's for the infrastructure that has been established for a significant period of time. And then it comes down to if the works that we are proposing will injuriously affect the land.
So, I'm just going to clarify that Aurora is now saying that the definition of minor operating is the replacement of poles is within 5 metres.
Which was, I think you saw that.
The submission itself says within the same or immediately adjacent location within the existing alignment of the distribution corridor. That's not quite.
So
you 5 metres within is the maximum.
This dovetails with the release. An issue about the roads, because a considerable amount of the infrastructure is sitting within road reserves. If that's permitted, then that deals with a lot of our concern. If it's not, then having that greater degree of flexibility becomes really important. The last issue I'd like to cover off is in relation to the height of support structures for overhead lines. Aurora made a submission on Rule 30.5.8 to exclude support structures for overhead lines from complying with the maximum height provisions for buildings of the zone in which they are located. Having to comply with this rule could result in Aurora having to obtain resource consent as a discretionary or non-complying activity depending on the zone they're operating in, and this overly restrictive approach in conflicts with objective 30.2.6 of the proposed plan. The height of the support structures is dictated by the surrounding environment and the need to achieve compliance with the safe electrical separation distances. The Section 42A report recommends rejecting Aurora's submissions, although there is not clear reasoning for this. It is submitted that Aurora has better knowledge and understanding regarding the scope of maintenance work required on its network, and therefore its evidence in this regard should be preferred. It is also unclear why telecommunications infrastructure gets the benefit of an exemption while electricity distribution does not. The reasons for using higher support structures as between those differing types of utilities is likely to be much the same.
Code sets out the height in relation to various matters.
to essentially NZ
NZP34.
I suspect that because of
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
Would, if we remind them to do that, would it be appropriate for the height to be in accordance with the requirements of that code? So that it's ceased, that it's not an unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
It obviously needs to be a little bit of wiggle room.
Generally,
the issue comes that we're not always on flat land, and that's where your issues are. And things also change, you know, from being traversable land to non-traversable, and that affects the levels you need to meet in the code. So I guess, yes, this is a good steer, but it shouldn't be the only.
Because you don't want unlimited, you know,
no.
60 meter transmission lines.
Well, we don't want 60 meter transmission lines either.
In terms of the telecommunications on the hooked up SaaS port structure, who owns the structure? Couldn't you just call it telecommunications structure and just come as it anyway?
I don't know how frequently it occurred.
In terms of urban areas, aren't telephone lines and power lines all on the same poles generally?
Sort of.
Sometimes.
The general design from over here has been that telephone goes down one side and power goes down the other.
Right.
And we have a sharing agreement over spanning service mains into people's houses.
Right.
You don't just need interference on the telephone lines.
And yes, exactly. I've seen them where they make them telecom lines down below, power ones are underneath on the same
pole.
I have.
But they have to be a certain distance apart. So.
I have to confess, my father used to be in the post office putting up telephone lines. I understand that issue.
So they're on a separate, so you generally have.
They're not always
poles on one side usually, and the
telecommunications
would own the ones on the other side here.
Yep. Mm. And there'll be a co-sharing over spanning to the individual properties.
Number of changes to the provisions of Chapter 30 to protect and enable development of its electricity distribution networks. It is submitted that these changes are necessary to appropriately provide for the efficient operation and development of the district's electricity supply. It is submitted that the protection of the sub-transmission network, including the Wanaka to Makarora line, is necessary to achieve the strategic directions, the RPS and the proposed RPS. Ensuring that these critical lines are protected will assist Queenstown Lakes' resilience and enable adaptation to changing electricity supply and demand. The changes sought by Aurora will also improve public and landowner knowledge of the relevant standards in close proximity to these lines and avoid inefficient regulatory processes or unintentional creation of risks to the electricity network. The changes sought by Aurora will reduce the risks to the public in and around these lines, enhance the reliability of the network, and help Aurora ensure that it can meet its obligations under the Civil Defence Emergency Act. The balance of the changes sought by Aurora will enable the efficient maintenance and operation of the remainder of the distribution network. This is a critical component of the plan to ensure that the well-being of the community, which relies on network utilities such as Aurora's, are provided for. Not making the changes sought by Aurora would represent a failure of the district plan to recognise the importance of the distribution network to the district and risk a loss in the quality of the electricity supply which enables the community to provide for its social and economic well-being. That's it from me.
And one that is just with regard to the fencing of a support structure, who this is applied to. But there's a statement saying that it's can affect the integrity of the support structure and result in more frequent maintenance and replacement requirements. And also about the visibility, whereas there's another school of thought that would say that, blending the, I don't know if you camouflage them, but painting them in such a way that they blend in more, it seems to make sense. I was just wondering if you could expand on why the painting of the structures result in more frequent maintenance requirements.
It depends, I guess, your the steel structures. There's a trade-off between painting and galvanising. And obviously painting, as you know with houses, once you paint it, you're constantly having to repaint. So there is, we have to keep that requirement of lending, we'll have to be repainting. And then with concrete poles and everything else, I guess it's really just that maintenance reoccurring on pole to blend in. It's not a common area, it's definitely not at all common to see coloured concrete poles in the industry at this point.
I mean, in essence, at the moment, the Glenorchy line is a really good example. That line's being replaced now, and the expectation is that we basically won't have to touch those poles for sort of 40 or 50 years. If those have to be painted, then it's likely that that maintenance rotation becomes much more frequent. In locations like the Glenorchy line, that then also requires us to facilitate sort of more frequent access to the location of the poles, which when you're surrounded by regenerating native vegetation, could mean that we have to go in and essentially keep that vegetation down around those poles so that we can get into them to be able to get up them to be able to paint them. And so there can be some effects that arise from that more frequent maintenance requirement that may actually have a greater impact from a visual perspective than just letting the galvanised steel poles sit there, get covered in dust, become quite dull and grey and difficult to see anyway. So that's the trade-off. And in our view, the painting of the actual support structure, bearing in mind that the insulators and so on can't be painted, they have to remain clear of paint in order to operate properly. So the benefit of that painting is really marginal, given the other effects of that and the potential to sort of draw attention to those structures by having to keep the area around them clear in order to enable more frequent maintenance work.
Yep, that makes perfect sense. Just to expand a bit further though, if you, for example, and I know it's unusual to have concrete coloured poles, but you can colour concrete prior to it becoming a pole. Mm-hmm. Colour steel on a roof can be colour steel on a roof, and I haven't painted my roof, I don't intend to. But those sort of things, and there are examples overseas of exactly that. And I'm just wondering if you introduced, rather than a galvanised steel pole, a colour steel, for want of a better descriptor, potentially you'd be no different from a galvanised pole or a standard concrete pole. It's just you're introducing a different scheme. Do you understand?
Yeah, I understand. I guess it's our access to those types of products, which has sort of transitioned this as well in what our statement is.
Sweet, thank you.
I've asked my question.
Okay. So the next person to speak to you is Mr. Sullivan.
Yes.
Thank you.
This is the sign of the window.
Thank you. Aurora Energy Limited is an electrical distribution business formed in 2003 as a wholly owned subsidiary of Dunedin City Holdings Limited. It is predominantly focused on the distribution of electricity to Dunedin City and Central Otago. Aurora is unique among New Zealand electricity distribution businesses as it is solely an asset owner with management and operations fully outsourced to its sister company, Delta Utility Services Limited. Aurora's network is hierarchical or branch-like in nature. It has a number of high voltage cables and lines which each carry a large amount of electricity and which each supply many thousands of customers. Electricity is transformed off these high voltage lines to thousands of low voltage lines which each serve anywhere between one and a few hundred customers. Given the number of customers supplied from each of these high voltage lines, the failure of any one of these high voltage lines has far greater impact than the failure of one or indeed many low voltage lines. Aurora's high voltage lines are critical to its network and critically important to the Queenstown Lakes region. Aurora is a lifeline utility as named in the Civil Defence Emergency Management Act 2002. Under the CEM Act, Aurora is required to ensure it is able to function to the fullest possible extent during and after an emergency. In recognition of the importance of this role, Aurora was an active participant in the Otago Lifelines Utility Vulnerabilities Project, which assessed the potential impacts of hazards on the region's lifeline infrastructure and identified mitigation strategies to reduce the risk to the community. One of Aurora's identified vulnerabilities is the risk of damage occurring to critical high voltage lines and our inability to readily undertake repairs safely. The Electricity Act 1992 provides some protection for lines that were legally installed under previous acts and regulations before 1992. This includes the right to occupy exclusively the space inhabited by the lines and to operate, inspect, maintain, replace and upgrade the lines because the lines have the status of existing works under the Electricity Act 1992. These rights are referred to as statutory easement rights or existing use rights. However, the Electricity Act 1992 does not include detailed obligations for landowners under the lines and does not prevent underbuild or land use incompatibility with the ongoing use and maintenance of such lines. It is therefore possible that buildings could be constructed and other activities undertaken beneath the lines. Therefore, in my view, the Electricity Act 1992 on its own does not afford sufficient protection from activities interfering with lines. The New Zealand Electrical Code of Practice for Electrical Safe Distances sets minimum safe electrical distance requirements for overhead electrical line installations and other works associated with the supply of electricity from generating stations to end users. The minimum safe distances have been set primarily to protect persons, property, vehicle and mobile plant from harm or damage from electrical hazards. The minimum distances are also a guide for the design of electrical works within substations, generating stations or similar areas where electrical equipment and fittings have to be operated and maintained. Under NZECP 34, notification to Aurora of a build is only required if the build falls within minimum distances. This does not always occur, and I have included in my evidence in chief examples of breaches of NZECP 34 which have occurred on the Aurora network. I therefore believe that having NZECP 34 prescriptions included within the district plan will assist in reducing the incidence of prohibited works, including underbuilds, earthworks and tree planting. The risk associated with such breaches can be minimised and or mitigated with suitable corridor protection rules in the proposed district plan. Without such corridor protection rules, there is a risk of development under or in close proximity to high voltage lines, as no other legislation applicable to the lines provides suitable safeguard from the development that may put this infrastructure at risk. Aurora seeks protection for just 16% of its distribution lines and cables, which are considered to meet the definition of critical infrastructure. Corridor protection is not sought for low voltage lines, or indeed the majority of Aurora's 6.6 11kV high voltage network. The lines that Aurora have identified for protection are critical to the supply of electricity within the Queenstown Lakes District. They secure a supply for important facilities that need to have secure electricity supply on a day-to-day basis, but also during disaster events, or they supply particularly isolated communities. While existing cases of underbuild will not be affected, will be able to be reversed by the insertion of corridor protection rules in the proposed district plan, it will stop any more instances occurring without Aurora having an opportunity to review and participate in the process. It will also increase the awareness of the critical lines and the care that needs to be taken when developing in close proximity to them. Thank you.
Just on the table on that page.
Yes.
I hope that's that the third column is the length of line that you wanted to have as critical line.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just...
Yeah, sorry, I can see why that might cause some confusion.
Could you just take us through the photos, please?
James, mm-hmm. So Joanne will take you through, she's the one who's put these photos together.
You're able to tell us where they are.
Hopefully.
But what I'd particularly like to know,
that first one's a crack. If we start. Well, that wasn't a PowerPoint, was it?
So that first photograph is probably just beyond the district boundary and just coming through on the main state highway where you've got the fruit, so it's actually related to the third picture. It was all taken on the same sort of site.
Oh, yes. So it's across the highway.
Yeah. And that's the same, I think those first three are all on that former highway.
So the first one, the second one, and the third one is that related to the crumble.
Yeah.
Just I recognise the fruit placement.
Yeah, on that second one. Okay, we saw it in here. I think this one, are of the same sort of area, and they're taken from, I believe, in the Gibson Valley somewhere. But what we can do is actually provide a map of the location, so that would assist with
That would be handy, because I recognise the links.
The next one's in Wanaka.
Well, what about Brownston Street?
Yes, this one's in Wanaka.
Yes. Interestingly, that's not one of the lines that you've sought to have.
I mean, the photos are just demonstrative of the type of thing
that we are actually seeing on the network.
Yes.
So, but that if we were to agree to the provisions that you said were included, what happened in Brownston Street? What sort of happened? And then you'd run around the lines. And the press wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I think that the banking end of a lot of those were all taken in Wanaka.
Yeah.
There was some construction. I think the issue here is that with the scaffolding and things like that, around, that that won't happen anymore with the new health and safety legislation. So that they're obviously been taken in 2008, so it was before that the new legislation was coming this year. We are working at an operational level to how we can address issues such as this, because our previous operations need now to comply with the health and safety legislation. So.
Just a question on that one in Brownsville Street, without looking at what the planning provisions are there, but just to me that that building is well within the height limits of that zone. Do those lines limit the ability of people to build up to the maximum potential in the zone? If they can add another floor to that building, for instance?
As long as they step back. If they were step back,
but they would still need
existing, with existing buildings.
Well, no, if there's a new one, they would have to sit back from that line.
You know, but I'm thinking in that instance, obviously, if they were to put another level on, they're already breaching. So I think that's already an instance of underbuild. And it may be somewhere that we would find it difficult to prevent them putting on another story. But what you get into then is actually sort of touch and reach potential, so it does become quite a serious sort of issue.
So especially with backpackers and people are taking selfies at
them. Yeah. It's the somebody could actually stand on that up veranda and touch.
On from Wellington, that's nothing unusual. Round boxes all through the streets and whatever. With ranges on them.
Under the code though, it's non, it's a breach.
Yeah.
I think in this instance, if you put that,
how do you get on to there? How do you get on to the veranda?
No, I can't
you can't.
No, you can't. But I mean, these types of existing scenarios, and we're not going to be winding the clock back on us. But if we have to do some sort of significant upgrade, or someone wants to build a building, we then get into an issue where we have the current code, which we have to comply with, and so you have to deal with that issue. So. The pictures that we've provided are really demonstrative of the types of things that Aurora are confronting across the network, and that we have to manage. Examples like that, there will be engineering solutions that can be applied to minimise the risk, you do. And if there were, say, a much taller building to go in there, my suspicion would be that as part of that, those lines would end up being undergrounded.
Yeah. So just so you're aware, the code does specifically address issues with balconies. It's got some pretty little diagrams there about how you actually assess the closeness of the conductor. That's in section 3.4, and that will be in my appendix 1. And basically, it does have some specific calculations that need to be carried out. Should you wish to extend that building?
Just on that building of the Gibson Gallery, it's an underbuild. Is that an overbuild or is that an underbuild? Or do the lines go over the building? The building doesn't look like a recent addition.
If it is, it's going to be worse.
It would be an underbuild given the age of our assets probably would have been there beforehand and then
no, in this case the line was definitely there first. And we're seeing that not just here, but in other districts as well, where we're seeking these same provisions. There are numerous instances where we've had where it was a Dunedin situation, but where the actual line was touching the roof of the underbuild. You know, so it is a significant problem for us. It makes it incredibly difficult for us to keep people safe, which at the end of the day is one of our primary reasons behind actually wanting to see this put into the district plans, is to keep people safe. It's not to be obstructive, it's not to limit people's enjoyment of the land, but rather to make sure that they live to fight another day.
And looking at that, having erected the first cowboy, and saying, looking at that picture, I think I was told by my boss that there's no way I was going to go anywhere near that. Is it the galvanized pole?
Mm-hmm. You think the law of physics with the system is a good reason to understand it.
It's probably only took 20 people to put it up because I was 15 years
old. Like, well, before going further, I'll adjourn to 2 o'clock.
Okay. I just want to finish just on time with those photographs. They were taken an hour in time to show
right.
The trees.
Yes.
So I know that too.
No, I'm just getting ready for lunch.
I think I've been cut off.